This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The last time I heard pianist and composer Dave Burrell perform solo, all I could think of was, we have to get him to play on our show. Well, today is that day. In the late 60s, Burrell was one of the mavericks of the jazz avant-garde. He's recorded with Archie Shepp and Pharoah Sanders. But he also loves early jazz styles. As our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has said, Burrell mixes the antique and the modern with a naturalness recalling Earl Hines, Monk, and Sun Ra. Like them, he evokes more than recreates early jazz styles. Burrell combines an avant-garde pianist's love of density with a buoyant old-timey sense of rhythm. Gary Giddens has called Burrell a scintillating solo performer. Thurston Moore of the band Sonic Youth put Burrell's album Echoes in the number one slot on his list of the top 10 free jazz underground recordings. Dave Burrell grew up in Middletown, Ohio, Harlem, and Hawaii. When his family moved to Hawaii after World War II, they were among the few African-American families there. Burrell's latest CD is called Expansion, and it features his group The Full-Blown Trio, drummer Andrew Cyril and bass player William Parker. Dave Burrell, welcome to Fresh Air. This is something I've been wanting to do for a long time, so
thanks.
Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And there's a song that's on your new CD that I'd love you to start with. I've also heard you perform it in concert. It's a real treat. This is your reworking of the Irving Berlin song, They Say That Falling in Love is Wonderful. Would you do it for us?
Sure.
Wonderful. I love the way you do that. You know, one of the things I just particularly love about your playing is that some of it's really rooted in the very early days of jazz. Ragtime, Jelly Roll Morton. At the same time, you've played a lot of free jazz. You're an avant-gardist. And the two kind of come together and meet in the middle in your playing. You're drawing on both ends, plus on the whole kind of history of American popular song. And I love the way you've kind of fallen in love with both historical ends and incorporated it for your own means.
Right. Thanks. I didn't really start off for it to be that way. I think that I was caught up in the avant-garde or free jazz movement in the mid-60s in New York, and I was still working on becoming a firmly rooted traditionalist. The players around me that I really respected were interested in both as well. John Coltrane was just departing from tradition and had really validated for all of us colleagues that it was okay if you had a firm tradition, a solid foundation, that you could go ahead and explore other ways of hearing, other ways of soloing, painting.
When did you start listening to and playing the music of Jelly Roll Morton?
I started when producer, historian Sam Charters did a public radio show in the late 80s. And he said to me that he heard in my playing what he heard in Morton's. And I wanted to know exactly what that was. And he told me that they were getting ready to do a special on the bicentennial of Morton's life, and he wanted me to be a part of it.
So you had to learn the music.
I did. And I thought it was easy. I went to Pedelson's and bought the book, and Monica said, "Could you play this?" It was a phone book. And I said, "Sure." And she said, "Let me hear one of them." And it was a disaster. And so I told Sam, "I'm not going to be ready by the deadline." And he said, "Oh, of course you will." And then he took me in the studio maybe a month later, and I did sort of squeak by with some of the stuff. And I fell in love with it. I felt that it was just what I needed to go to at that time.
Well, a few years after that, you recorded an album that was Jelly Roll Morton compositions and some originals in that vein. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you to play a Jelly Roll Morton composition for us now, and this is The Crave. Do you want to say anything about it before you play it?
Yes, The Crave is one of the most significant of all of his rags because it has the Spanish tinge, which is bum, 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 bum. And that ingredient at the time, Morton, when I heard him talk to Alan Lomax at the Smithsonian, he said to Lomax that that ingredient was very necessary part of the jazz of his era to be included.
So this is Dave Burrell at the piano playing Jelly Roll Morton's The Crave.
Thank you.
Dave Burrell playing Jellero Morton's The Crave. And Dave Burrell has a new CD with his group, The Full Blown Trio, and it's called Expansion. Could you illustrate a little bit what's happening in The Crave that we just heard? What makes that Jellero Morton?
Yeah. Matilda bass line is evident, the Caribbean influence in this last strain. So it gets as folky as you can imagine, and that's so very rare for the very first jazz composition to be written down and to have the European ingredients, because, of course, he studied with European teachers. He has the sort of the neighborhood sound. He has a sophisticated technique, and yet he has the street sound of the brothel.
Now, you had already played a lot of free jazz and avant-garde jazz before playing Jellero Morton. Were there things in the Morton compositions that struck you as being almost avant-garde in some way? Do you know what I mean? Of being much more modern than you would have thought they could have been in the 1920s.
Yes, yes. Bass lines that are so very syncopated that they're timeless, and it doesn't matter what you attach them to. You could have a Morton-inspired bass line at this release point, for example, on The Crave. That note at the end, it's just sort of shoved into the ensemble of notes as an intrusive pedal point sound, which has just sort of been mimicked throughout the decades. And it still doesn't have a rival as far as the effectiveness that it brings to the composition swing. The rest of the release of the piece, I'll demonstrate now how it sort of flowers out and ends, and the tension is released. So
to learn?
Yeah, it was for me. I don't think that anyone really has difficulty with the notes, because they call it third grade classical music, they compare it to. But what it needs is a lot of strength, and it needs a lot of thrust to enable to execute the syncopation.
When you were playing free jazz, I mean, you came to New York in the 60s?
65.
And you were playing free jazz. You were playing with people like Ornette Coleman, Marion Brown, Pharoah Sanders. And was it hard to find a place for yourself in free jazz as a pianist? Sure, there's Cecil Taylor, but Ornette Coleman, for instance, didn't have a piano in his group. And I think a lot of free jazz players might have felt that, you know, piano just harmonically didn't belong.
That's correct. That's what most everybody said. And the piano players had to figure out how to not disturb this new trend. And so what I started doing was learning the melodies, and I'd play along with the horns. And I wouldn't play any chords. And so I became a horn myself. And if it was a short, snappy head like then I was out, and the horn went on to solo with the bass and drum. And then later on, the horn soloist frontline people would turn around to me, and they didn't want chords. They wanted color and rhythm from me. So I had to play clusters that sounded in the idiom of where the melody and the solo, where it had come to, with something like a cluster like what I just played wouldn't disturb it. So maybe the horn player is up here. And I just went. So that was working sometimes. I think that the most difficult part was the horn players were just figuring out how to become very energetic and not play within some box or some framework. So you can imagine someone just taking a motif and arguing the motif as vigorously as they chose, and the pianist going. So the drums and the rhythm section are all doing a chant that stays the same. The horns, however, are leaving the immediate premise.
Was it ever frustrating? Here's this like free jazz, and the horns are being like liberated to scream and do whatever they want. But you, as the pianist, are kind of boxed in. You know, they don't want chords. You're doing like clusters. You're doing this repetitive line underneath them.
Right.
So it wasn't, sounds like it wasn't that liberating for you.
It wasn't that liberating, but it was challenging. And then later, after we heard back what we had, for example, with this Upper and Lower Egypt motif that Pharoah Saunders wrote that I just played, when we did that in Rudy Van Gelder's studio in New Jersey, Bob Thiel was producing, he said, well, that's a great formula. You just have the chant, the rhythm section is blocking along, and you have all of this wild freedom on the front line. And then later, the pianist can go ahead and take his solo while everybody else sleeps.
And not the audience.
Yeah. No, not the audience. So then I thought, oh my goodness, now it's my turn. Now what am I going to do? And I had to figure out some other stuff to do.
So what did you do?
I did have an interlude function that became very necessary because everybody was exhausted anyway. And I was going deaf from cymbals in my ear.
At the same time that you were, you know, playing all this free jazz in concert, would you go home and then try to learn like Scott Joplin rags? Because that has been such a fundamental part of who you are.
Yes. In the back of our minds, most of the innovators knew what Coltrane had done, and I think that he was the leader of being able to say, well, I departed after I've thoroughly explored the so-called inside, and I wrote Giant Steps, and I feel now that I must move on to not only into atonal music, but to modes and other approaches. And I have my credentials in order. That's Mr. Coltrane talking, and I think everybody else in the jazz community would agree.
Now, I think, tell me if this is right, that John Coltrane's Giant Steps is based on an exercise?
Yeah, it is based on a chord progression that has been taken after its initial. That chord progression has a linkage that takes it to an identical chord progression in another key. So. So it's something that he put together. He got a motif probably from a book like Nicholas Lanevsky's. You could call it an etude, like a Chopin etude, to get better in scurrying around different chord changes for him personally.
Now, Giant Steps, a lot of horn players have played that, and mm-hmm. it's, I think, usually a horn musician's, you know, tune. You do it on piano. You have like a stride piano version of Giant Steps.
Mm-hmm.
Would you play it for us?
Sure.
And this is Dave Burrell at the piano. You play, I think, how strong your fingers are.
Well, a lot of the avant-garde pianists, from having to keep up with drummers that were so strong, like Elvin Jones and Andrew Surreal, even Philly Joe, not to mention Max Roach, but in order to say, be there in and be heard and be in the mix, you found that you played a lot harder than you thought you could. And oftentimes, when the ensemble was finished and they had played for an hour, they would want a piano solo. So you would have to keep playing.
You know, tendonitis is such a problem for a lot of musicians, particularly pianists. So when you're playing with that kind of finger strength all the time and volume and that percussive quality become really important, are you putting your fingers at risk?
I think so. I think that you develop a technique that's kind of like a beat-up boxer's technique. You can still go in the ring and throw one, but maybe he's been hurt. I know I've taped my fingers and I've nicked them on ivory that was not smooth and not been able to play because I ripped off a nail or something. Especially 20 years ago when trying to just be as aggressive, say, as Cecil Taylor.
You grew up from the age of 6 till you were a young adult in Hawaii.
Right.
Your parents are from the States.
Right.
How did they end up with you in Hawaii?
Well, we were the first African-American family outside of the military to settle there. And it happened right after World War II.
To settle in Hawaii or just in Honolulu?
To settle in Hawaii, as far as we know.
Wow.
And it was great for me because I met people from all over the world. We were at a settlement called Palama Settlement in Kalihi, and at that time it was a post-war recreation, art, and cultural center. that my mom taught piano lessons, where she taught piano lessons, and my dad was doing his thesis on his a sociologist just passed away at 91 about Hawaii being the melting pot of the Pacific.
Was growing up in Hawaii a good experience?
It was an incredibly good experience. And what ultimately I ended up doing was having a rhythm and blues band, and I was on television every Saturday afternoon.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, what a media family, because your mother did a jazz radio show
in
Hawaii,
right? Yeah, she
had
a radio show in Waikiki, and I was on TV, and I played at the military bases, too.
You've talked about some of the many elements that have gone into your music. Did you hear a lot of traditional Hawaiian music growing up in Hawaii, and did that have an impact on your own composition?
I did.
Could you just play a few bars of one of those Hawaiian-influenced pieces?
Sure.
Dave Burrell, it's just been great talking with you and hearing you play. I'm so glad we did this. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Pianist and composer Dave Burrell recorded in our studio. His latest CD is called Expansion. He lives in Philadelphia, but spends a lot of time performing around the world. In fact, tonight he leaves for Rome. He's written an opera based on his experiences coming of age in Hawaii, which he hopes to find the backing to stage.